From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Well, Tony, it's been a while, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to speak with you, and it sure has been very busy in that part of the world, where I just spent a week, by the way, in beautiful La Habana, Cuba.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm especially interested in, Don, because I look at what's going on in Cuba very much from the outside, and is how the process for what many people are calling the transition from the revolutionary generation of the 1950s to a new generation is proceeding. And you've probably had a chance to get a good insight into that.
A little bit, yeah. Apparently, the feeling there is that this has already been accomplished in the main end quite some time ago. So I guess, they anticipated that Fidel would get old, and that the other colleagues from the revolutionary days would get old, and that it's time for the next generation, and they are pretty much in control of things already and have been for a few years now.
Yeah, and the recent elections were a really astonishing exercise in democracy in comparison with what goes on, for example, in Colombia. And I think I'm right in saying that the turnout was over 80% in the Cuban
correct.
Elections.
Yep, that's right.
Whereas in Colombia, it was under 50%.
Right. And in places like Honduras, it doesn't matter what the turnout is and how they vote, because whoever they want, the United States wants to be in power is who wins, regardless of the actual count.
or in Haiti or in any of those countries where U.S. Regimes dominate.
Well, if you win in Haiti, I think you get to reside in the Central African Republic. I think that's where the presidential palace is for Haiti if you happen to win.
It's really good to know that Cuba is making progress with its political and economic system, because you also mentioned that in a conversation that we had a little earlier that Cuba is making good progress in getting rid of its anomalous dual currency system. And that's good news too, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, they had set up this dual currency to accommodate the tourism that began in earnest about over the last decade, and the anticipation of seeing tourism from the U.S., which began a couple of years ago. It's in substantial terms. I mean, there's a couple of flights out of New York every day direct to Havana from JFK, and on JetBlue, there's also flights from Atlanta and Miami on, daily back and forth. And they're pretty full. And you see people from Canada, EU, Australia, lots of folks from China and Japan. There were two Japanese families in the house that I was staying in. And so they, as this, influx of people from around the world came in, you had the economic conditions on the ground were, the consequence of at the time 50 some odd years of embargo. What they did was establish a currency that was exchangeable for hard currency, but was a Cuban currency. In other words, you can't spend dollars, you have to buy the Cuban exchange currency, and then you can buy these things at that are available to tourists, because this currency, what they call the CUC, or the Cuban unit of currency, which is this exchange currency, is 24 Cuban pesos, which is the country's actual currency. So you've had like a dual track of goods and services available, sort of analogous to what they had in the Soviet Union and some of the Warsaw Pact countries back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s in the Beryozka stores, where anybody can go in and buy it, but you have to have hard currency. And since no one will exchange hard currency for pesos, foreigners had preference. Now, there was a decision to do that in order to induce tourism, and apparently that's been so successful that they are now going to basically unify the currency so there aren't two. There are contradictions, because you have, like we had in the Soviet Union at that time, In a country where the housing is free, all of the necessities of life are free or very cheap, wages and the public policy is equality. The wage difference between, say, a clerk in a store and the person running a teaching hospital, not a substantial wage difference. Where in the United States, it might be this one makes $25,000 a year and this one $2 million. You know, there it's much closer. And the thing that happened with this currency is that suddenly taxi drivers are making, 10 or 50 times as much because they're getting paid in hard currency as, say, medical doctors, surgeons, lawyers, et cetera. Their contradictions like that are now under discussion and action in order to sort of attempt to resolve all of it as they do this currency thing. But I was told by an authoritative figure that the currency situation is expected to be taken care of over the next months.
Right. And obviously all this is a result of the United States embargo and boycott against Cuba.
That's right.
And just as it was in the days of the 1980s here in Nicaragua, when the same kinds of contradictions arose here in Nicaragua directly as a result of the United States government boycott and sanctions, economic sanctions. Right. And talking about that, maybe we should start talking about Venezuela.
For sure, because they're going through, the similar, consequences. Essentially, what we're talking about is, since the Cuban Revolution, the United States has conducted economic warfare against Cuba. And since the coup in 2002, but really since 1998, when Hugo Chavez was elected, the U.S. has been conducting economic warfare against Venezuela as well, with the full cooperation and or the instruction from the United States, the action of the local bourgeoisie.
Yeah, and the most decisive decision in the current phase of the United States economic war and also diplomatic, media, and to some extent military war,
right,
because of the military preparations that the Southern Command is making in the case of a U.S. intervention in Venezuela, which they always portray as humanitarian, like they did in Libya and Iraq and everywhere else. And the decisive moment was Barack Obama's decision to declare Venezuela back in 2015 as a threat to the security of the United States.
I know.
And Donald Trump has taken a couple of decisions to intensify that over the first couple of years of his presidency. And the latest decision by President Trump in the United States government's economic war against Venezuela was the decision to sanction any U.S. citizen who engages in transactions involving Venezuela's new cryptocurrency, the Petro.
Right.
Because of the very nature of the Petro as a cryptocurrency, it's going to be very difficult for the United States authorities to police that decision by President Trump. And the Petro itself has been, extremely successful in its launch and its pre-sale phase. It had something over $5 billion worth of offers to buy the Petro.
Not bad.
And currently a delegation is in Moscow at a conference about the technology, the so-called blockchain technology, on which all the cryptocurrencies are based. And I've always been quite skeptical about the cryptocurrencies, because it's not clear to me that the advantages of the blockchain chain technology warrant all the hype that has especially grown up around, for example, the Bitcoin. But I can see that the way the Venezuelan government is implementing that blockchain technology is significantly different from Bitcoin, because they have real resources with which to back up its value, namely oil and minerals, including gold.
Yeah.
Recently, there was an announcement that Venezuela, I've forgotten, it has enormous, they just made this announcement that Venezuela does have enormous gold reserves.
Right.
Gold in the ground.
Right.
So, you know, and let's see how that pans out. So far, it looks as though the Petro is going to be in the internal terms of Venezuela's economy. It looks as though the Petro will be a viable alternative that will make it much harder for outside manipulators of who try and arbitrage an artificial value of the Venezuelan currency, the Bolivar, via websites like Dollar Today,
right,
in conjunction with the Colombian authorities, who have allowed their the private foreign exchange dealers all along the Venezuelan border to fix an artificial value,
right,
of the Colombian currency against the Venezuelan currency. So
yeah, they're trying to sink the Venezuelan currency. This is warfare. Exactly.
So and the Petro, it looks as though the Petro is going to, it's not a complete solution by any means, but it's a sufficiently significant solution to make a big difference in terms of Venezuela's domestic economy, and we'll see how that pans out over the next 3, 4, 5 months.
Yeah, you know, you've got an interesting context for this also, because Monday, China started offering Petro Yuan on the markets in Shanghai, the International Energy Exchange. In other words, a Petro Chinese currency backed by China's gold. Now, you're talking with oil. There's an annual trade value of about $14 trillion, which is roughly equivalent to China's gross domestic product last year.
So much less than the U.S. GDP.
Okay, and so the potential there is enormous.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And so and you can see that, the way that Russia and China are trading their energy transactions in their national currencies, the ruble and the yuan.
That's right.
You're finding that Iran is able to has been able to successfully defeat U.S. sanctions, and it's also working very closely with China and Russia, not just on the diplomatic front, but very much on the economic front as well. Pakistan has just made an announcement that it's not going to engage in any aggression against Iran, you know, which is,
right,
you know. So the diplomatic, economic, and financial fronts are obviously very much interrelated. And it's, whereas in the rest of Latin America, superficially it looks as though the regional elites that are allied with the U.S. government are very much in the ascendancy for the moment. Now, in the overall global position is that a multipolar world has already emerged.
That's right.
And is well on its way to setting up financial economic structures that will render the U.S. ascendancy or dominance, the United States government, and kind of vicariously its allies in Western Europe, they've enjoyed for ever since the end of the Second World War, and that is now definitely over. And you can see, and I was writing about this in an article yesterday, you can see how while the regional elites here in Latin America are determined to follow the models, the failed models, of their North American and European patrons. And they also have to accommodate, and we've talked about this in many conversations over the last few months, they also have to accommodate their own greedy interests as regional elites, but also their country's own national interests, with the reality that China is now the dominant global economic power.
Right.
And no. I don't think it's premature to say that.
I don't either.
because if it were not the case, and President Trump wouldn't be engaging, wouldn't be trying to start a trade war with China in a desperate attempt to protect America's commercial position in the world. You know? So then, going back to Venezuela, and what you can see there is that in that global context that you've just pointed out, and the situation in Venezuela is absolutely crucial in regional terms, and this is also something we've been talking about over many conversations over the past months, because if the United States can get its proxies into power in Venezuela, then the essential motor that has enabled the Cuban Revolution not just to survive the last 10-15 years, but actually to progress,
right,
and experience economic growth and develop its own economy in over the last 15 years, Venezuela has been the motor that has helped Bolivia, Nicaragua, and Ecuador to survive the post 2008 crisis recession successfully, and all Bolivia and Nicaragua have they're among the top two or three countries in Latin America, according to the United Nations Economic Commission for Latin America, right, and the Caribbean, in terms of economic growth, in terms of all, right, kinds of indicators, reducing inequality.
Yep.
And that's also true of Venezuela.
That's right.
Despite the crisis of the last couple of years.
Right. I mean, so, you can't buy whatever it is that they're, you know, playing around with this week, whether toilet paper or, you know, laundry soap or whatever. But by the way, there's 1.5 million new housing units that have come online in the last 5 years, and those things measure into the column of economics as well.
Yeah, and that's why politically, President Nicolas Maduro is on track to win re-election in the presidential, right, election scheduled for May the 22nd.
Right,
and you know, and the in that regional context, should Nicolas Maduro successfully win those presidential elections, and it's not at all clear, and the opposition, the main opposition candidate, Henry Falcon, is going to be able to prevent that. Although Falcon himself, it has to be said, Falcon himself and the right-wing polling companies are projecting a win by 4 or 5 or 6 percentage points for Falcon if, right, the elections were held today.
Right.
The reality is, we've seen in election after election in Venezuela, is that right-wing election polls always overstate the case for their projections for the opposition candidates, and they always end up with egg on their face when the results finally come in.
Well, now they're not really. I mean, look, the point of those polls is not to do a scientific analysis for third party use objectively, but rather they're weapons, public relations weapons that are part and parcel of the campaign. That was true here in the United States too. By the way, let's go back to all of the polling data up to like 10 minutes before the final vote count came in. It showed that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president of the United States. They all said that.
Oh, yeah, but that was the Russians, Don.
Oops.
That ridiculous propaganda, again, the Russians did it. And you find that cropping up constantly in reporting on Latin America as well, you know. And whereas the mainstream corporate media continually play down the growing influence of China in the region, and they're constantly raising the specter of the Russian manipulation in Venezuela, Russian manipulation in Cuba, for example. And it's like a modern-day version of the olden times Red Scares, you know?
That's right. Go ahead. Sorry.
And you still get that also in relation to Nicaragua, for example, because Russia has assisted Nicaragua with its satellite technology, and part of that assistance has been and the establishment of a Russian satellite ground station in Nicaragua. And the United States, I think there was an article in the Washington Post in around July, August last year, claiming that this was evidence of Russian military interference in Central America,
right.
And which is laughable when you look at, you know, there's one tiny little Russian satellite ground station somewhere in Nicaragua with maybe two or three Russian personnel. And all around Nicaragua, there are hundreds and thousands of U.S. military personnel at the military bases in Honduras, in Soto Cano, in Comalapa, in El Salvador. And there, at any given time, there could be thousands of U.S. military personnel in Costa Rica.
And, by the way, all along Russia, too, by the way.
Right. So anyway, and that's... Going back to Venezuela, there'll be an election, a presidential election, also legislative elections, I think, in Venezuela over the next few months, and the presidential elections are going to be separate from the legislative elections. But and all the signs are that the current government of Nicolas Maduro will be successful in achieving re-election for President Maduro, and that they're likely to reverse the current opposition majority in the National Assembly. But obviously, time will tell. The other big event happening over the weekend and this weekend is, certainly for us here in Nicaragua, is the election in Costa Rica, where there's likely to be very little change, but one never really knows. And the two candidates in the runoff election following the first round elections earlier this year are they're both called Alvarado. Carlos Alvarado is the candidate for the ruling party, the PAC, and the guy called Fabricio Alvarado is a more right-wing candidate. Yeah. Whoever wins that election, in terms of Costa Rica's international policy, that there's likely to be very little change.
Right.
Although there might be some change in domestic policy.
Yeah.
But who knows? We'll just have to see how things pan out. It's possible that if a more right-wing candidate wins in Costa Rica, they may drive with greater determination to incorporate themselves into the Pacific Alliance countries and the countries aligned more insistently with United States government policy across the region, but we don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
The much bigger events in terms of the south of the region are that President Kuczynski has had to resign in Peru as a result of corruption allegations,
right.
And that may have effects on the Americas summit scheduled for the 12th, 13th of April, to which President Trump has said he's going to take part. And also that raises the question of what's going to happen with the participation of Venezuela, and if Venezuela isn't allowed to participate because President Kuczynski, before his resignation, told President Maduro that he wasn't invited, which is unprecedented in terms of regional diplomatic relations.
Really?
Because although the summit of the Americas is hosted by a given country, and that given country is not usually the country that decides who's to be invited, because
right.
In years past, Cuba was always denied permission to participate in those kinds of summits, but as of two or three summits ago. And a great majority of Latin American countries insisted that Cuba should participate, and so Cuba's expected to participate. And it'll be interesting to see what happens, because if Peru insists that Venezuela shouldn't participate, what will be the reaction of the other ALBA countries, including
right.
Ecuador, despite its current social democrat
right.
centrist government?
Right.
Even they have said that it's not permissible for Peru to refuse the participation of Venezuela's president. And who knows what's going to happen? We'll see. We've only got a couple of weeks before that happens,
yeah.
And that'll be a very interesting indication of the kind of balance of power within the region in terms of, you know, is the United States able to force its Latin American vassal states to engage in behavior that is essentially very prejudicial to their interests.
Yeah.
In the same way that they've done with the European Union over Russia, for example.
Right.
And that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
And the other big thing that's been happening over the last couple of weeks has been the case in the International Court of Justice between Bolivia and Chile,
right,
whereby Bolivia is reclaiming its right to access to the Pacific Ocean after well over 100 years of military occupation by Chile of Bolivian territory since the 1879 war. Now, Chile is arguing that a treaty agreed in 1904 between Bolivia and Peru gives it sovereign rights over the territory that it conquered back in 1879. And Bolivia is saying that and whatever the rights and wrongs of that treaty, and Chile has an obligation to negotiate Bolivia's sovereign access to the Pacific Ocean. So the legal arguments, the detail of the legal arguments is quite complicated. But essentially, Bolivia is saying that Chile has to negotiate sovereign access to the sea on the basis of a whole series of precedents,
right,
over the last 100 years.
Right.
And Chile is saying that it has no obligation to negotiate. And essentially, the case in the ICJ, the International Court of Justice in The Hague, is, you know, will they tell Bolivia, will they order Chile to negotiate or not?
Right. Yeah, so, you know, you've got also the situation in Brazil with Lula still,
yeah,
and we're getting close to time here, but it appears that all stops are being pulled to try to prevent him from running for president, because if he does, he'll win, including he's been doing a march across the country that was attacked violently over the past week.
Yeah, in the south of the country, which is predominantly right wing, and the caravana, as they call it,
right,
of Inácio Lula da Silva's attempts to mobilize support for his presidential candidacy in the July, I think they're in late July or early August elections, presidential elections in Brazil, it was attacked and actually fired at, which is absolutely,
right,
unprecedented. Now, it was shot at by a three-vehicle caravan, and the first two vehicles, in which, thankfully, Lula da Silva was not traveling, were hit by gunfire.
Right.
And even President Temer, the usurper president in Brazil at the moment, he was moved to condemn,
right,
those violent attacks. The nitty gritty there is that, and as we talked about it over many conversations previously, the judicialization of politics has come to the point in Brazil, as in Argentina and elsewhere,
right,
where evidence doesn't matter. There's no hard evidence on which to base the sentence that was handed down by Brazil's courts against Lula da Silva,
right,
for corruption. There's absolutely no hard evidence. It's all based on supposition.
Right.
Supposition. Now, the legally, his lawyers have presented a habeas corpus case, which, if it's successful in a judgment on April the 4th, if the Supreme Court rules that submission from Lula's defense lawyers has merit, then he will be able to be a candidate in the presidential elections. And if they rule against that, then he won't.
And we'd like to thank you. And next week we can pick up there and also look at Argentina, where the reaction to the regime imposed by similar game playing is taking place in the streets over public sector layoffs. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Okay, and you, Don. Look forward to talking to you.
Me too. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.